From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Zoe Mitchell. This is a special hour of Radio Boston marking 100 years of women's suffrage. Coming up, a historian says Massachusetts, not Seneca Falls, is where the suffrage movement began.
When they were told to sit down and shut up, they did not. And that is really the start of the women's rights movement, when women began to speak out, arguing for their right to have a voice.
Plus, racism and the role of African-American women in the movement.
So where are black women if they are not affiliating in great numbers with these newborn suffrage associations?
And you don't own me. The protest music that defined it.
There's protest music all over, if you know where to look for it. And some of it's on the top 40 charts, some of it's on the pop charts.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome to a special July 4th edition of Radio Boston. I'm Zoe Mitchell. 100 years ago, on June 25th, 1919, Massachusetts became the eighth state to ratify the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed women the right to vote. But it wasn't until over a year later, in August of 1920, that suffrage for all became the law of the land. Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido spoke at Faneuil Hall last week at a celebration of that first anniversary.
This progress that we've made over 100 years just didn't happen. It happened because you had women putting their shoulder behind change and effort to make this progress happen. And that it's a moment where we can teach our daughters about the decades of progress, but about the future and what their responsibilities are.
The fight for women's suffrage lasted generations. Stemming from the abolitionist movement, the concerted effort for the 19th Amendment, spearheaded by women like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucy Stone, spanned over 70 years. Even after ratification, the fight was not over. While the 19th Amendment granted access to the ballot box, it in no way guaranteed it, especially for African American women. All this hour on Independence Day, we're bringing you a special hour of Radio Boston, marking 100 years of women's suffrage. Many people think of these words as the beginning of the movement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the Declaration of Sentiments from the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention for Women's Rights. As you heard, it echoes the U.S. Declaration of Independence with the added words, and women. That manifesto ends with a ringing call for women to have all the rights of citizenship. But historian Barbara Berenson says that Seneca Falls was not really the start of the suffrage movement, but a rebirth. Berenson is the author of Massachusetts and the Women's Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers. And when she spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty last year, she said the real impetus of the suffrage movement began in the state of Mass, 11 years earlier, in the summer of 1837, with the work of two women, the Grimke sisters.
Angelina and Sarah Grimke were two extraordinary women from Charleston, South Carolina. They were the white daughters of a wealthy slave-owning family, and they left Charleston, went to Philadelphia, and became involved in the abolitionist movement, which at that point was a very new movement. And Angelina and Sarah became such passionate abolitionists that they were trained to be anti-slavery agents to go out and speak against slavery, and were sent on a tour throughout Massachusetts in the summer of 1837.
They were advocating for abolition, though. How did that then lead them to pushing for suffrage.
What happened was it was really not accepted in that era that women would speak out on political issues at all, and certainly, above all, not accepted that women would speak to audiences of men and women about political issues. But that's precisely what Angelina and Sarah Grimke did. And leaders in Massachusetts, including particularly Congregational church leaders, tried to shut them down and said that what they were doing was unacceptable and, in fact, would bring degeneracy and ruin upon society.
Oh, sure.
They resisted, they refuted, and they fought back.
Yeah, but you quote Angelina Grimke as writing, "I contend that woman has just as much right to sit in solemn council in conventions, conferences, associations, and general assemblies as men, just as much right to sit in the presidential chair of the United States."
Correct. So in 1837, when they were told to sit down and shut up, they did not. They continued speaking, and they wrote a powerful series of letters defending a woman's rights to speak out on political issues, including making statements such as the one you just read. And that, I argue in my book, is really the start of the women's rights movement, when women began to speak out, arguing for their right to have a voice in political issues.
Yeah. So can you read a little bit to us from the introduction of the book? Because, again, we have the privilege of looking back at what was happening in 1837, 1848, 1850 from the lens of 2018. I think we just need to be reminded how radical it really was, advocating for suffrage. And I'd love if you could just read a little bit from the book.
Certainly. Women advocating for the right to vote faced difficulties that are almost unimaginable from our contemporary perspective. They had to challenge centuries of domestic tradition, church teachings, and legal doctrines that confined women to the domestic sphere and excluded them from civic participation. No wonder success required a campaign waged by three generations of courageous, visionary, and persistent women activists. Their victory was never inevitable.
I want to ask you, Barbara, I'm still taken by the fact that the Grimke sisters, for example, felt a sense of their own political empowerment because of the abolitionist movement. I mean, that seems to be kind of central to the emergence of pro-suffrage activity in Massachusetts because the state was such a hotbed of abolition. Could you see the two happening independently of each other, or are they inextricably intertwined?
The women's rights movement emerged directly from within the abolitionist movement, and it was the leaders of the abolitionist movement, such as William Lloyd Garrison, who welcomed women to be full participants in the movement, which was an incredibly radical position.
So tell us, and I want to hear about some of the more key women here. Lucy Stone, we haven't talked about her. Who was she?
Lucy Stone graduated from Oberlin College in 1847 and immediately began lecturing both in support of women's rights and against slavery. And she became perhaps the most popular lecturer during the 1840s and 1850s, both for women's rights and against slavery. She also was a key organizer of the first National Women's Rights Convention right here in Worcester in 1850.
Okay. So tell us more about that, because I think many people may have a passing knowledge of Seneca Falls, at least, but I don't think the Worcester Convention of 1850 really comes up in folks' mind. What happened there?
So the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 was certainly a very important convention. It was a local convention. It was women in upstate New York. And there were a couple of other local conventions also in the late 1840s. Lucy Stone and her allies had this brilliant idea that they should organize a national convention. And about 1,000 women from 11 different states congregated in Worcester in 1850 to have a whole convention dedicated to women's rights. And not only did they have this convention, but then they set up a system of annual conventions. So there were annual conventions virtually every year during the 1850s. They also established committees to carry out all sorts of organizing and advocacy between conventions. It really was the start of the organized movement.
I see. So it provided the momentum for that. Okay.
Correct.
So 1850s, though, I mean, we're headed straight towards the Civil War. That obviously disrupted these efforts dramatically.
The Civil War was a great interrupter. What happened during the Civil War was Lucy Stone, along with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, turned their attention to supporting the war effort, to supporting the effort to eradicate slavery from the nation. And then they resumed with the women's rights movement really right after the Civil War ended in 1865.
But that produced a schism between these women.
That produced an enormous schism, putting Lucy Stone on the one side and Anthony and Stanton on the other side, and the schism was over the 15th Amendment, which of course granted the right to vote to black men but left women out.
So Stone nevertheless supported the 15th Amendment, right?
Correct. Stone said it was terrible that women were left out, but it's wonderful that somebody is getting the vote, and therefore I support the 15th Amendment and will continue to dedicate my efforts now to enfranchising women.
And Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony did not support it.
Correct.
This is a side of them that I haven't heard about all that much. I mean, you write about that Stone found Anthony's and Stanton's racist commentary during the debate over the amendment unpardonable.
It's a part of Anthony and Stanton's history that certainly scholars know well, but is almost absent from popular culture, from popular knowledge of them. But yes, they opposed the 15th Amendment in horrifyingly racist terms.
Sorry, I mean, it just takes my breath away a little bit because we think of them as these champions of women's rights, and I guess in our minds it just bleeds into civil rights as a whole.
Right. And of course, I mean, later on, there was a reconciliation between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass, for example. I mean, they were great heroines of American history in many ways. But there was this, you know, horrible, unpardonable racism after the Civil War over the 15th Amendment. That story has not been well known.
Interesting. Okay. Now, what about African-American women in this movement? Because obviously they suffered the double burden of both racism and slavery and, being women, disenfranchised women as well.
When the schism occurred after the Civil War, the Lucy Stone Wing, which was based here in Boston, welcomed black women into the movement. The Anthony Stanton Wing, which was based in New York, did not. Later in 1890, when the two groups were reconciled, the joint movement, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, was primarily, although not entirely, a white movement. And in 1890, when the joint movement was formed, it was the height of Jim Crow. These women knew that they were going to have to ultimately get Southern support. Many of them, of course, were somewhat racist or largely racist anyway. And they made a compromise with the devil, so to speak, to not worry about whether or not black women would be enfranchised. They tacitly agreed they would turn a blind eye to that Southern attempts to restrict voting by black women as well as by black men.
That's Barbara Berenson, the author of Massachusetts and the Women's Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers. She spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2018. As Barbara Berenson said, the racism and racial tension in the suffrage movement is well known by academics, but it's been absent from wider public memory. Also missing from the understanding of what happened over a century ago, a full acknowledgement of the contributions of black women in the fight for the right to vote. Historian Martha Jones says part of the reason is because we haven't had the same level of scholarship on black women's history. Jones teaches history at Johns Hopkins. She is also a Society of Black Alumni presidential professor. Her work examines how black Americans have shaped the story of American democracy. She spoke with us from her hotel room in Athens. You can hear the difference in sound quality, but it's worth listening to.
African American women in 1848, it turns out, are debating their rights. They don't come to Seneca Falls, New York, as people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott do. And instead, they convene in places like Philadelphia, where the African Methodist Episcopal Church is meeting, and black church women show up in that setting because their sense of what rights entails in 1848 are things like preaching licenses. Women are looking for authority and autonomy in religious culture. So when we turn our sights away from the well-known story of a place like Seneca Falls, and we follow actual black women, when we learn where they were and ask what they were doing, it turns out in those settings they are also talking quite forcefully about the question of their rights.
I'd be interested to ask you, so Radio Boston spoke with another historian, Barbara Berenson, about a split in the suffrage movement. you know, with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton opposing the 15th Amendment, not initially welcoming black women into their cause. You know, there were other women like Lucy Stone from Massachusetts who wanted to include them from the beginning. I guess I would be curious, you know, black women had their own activism going on. You know, how did they respond to tensions like this within this suffrage movement?
There's a lot been written about the meetings during the 1860s of the Equal Rights Association. Overlooked oftentimes in the reading of those debates is that there is at least one African-American woman present, an African-American woman who goes on the record, and that is Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. When we read her ideas during those debates, we can see the ways in which she, as a black woman, is crafting her own political philosophy about these very important questions. And Watkins Harper offers this extraordinary vision for the political culture of the nation going forward. And it is this. She says, "We are all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity." Because she cannot choose, right, easily, if at all, between the interests of sex or the interests of race.
Women like Watkins Harper, you know, was it important for her to work alongside these women? You know, what happened after that?
In the wake of those fraught American Equal Rights Association meetings, we get the creation of two women's suffrage organizations, the National and the American. And while the two organizations have differing philosophies and different strategic approaches to the question of women's suffrage, we find African Americans, men and women, affiliating with one and the other. Right? So black Americans are not of one mind about how to approach the question of women's suffrage going forward. However, the numbers are small. And again, we have to ask the question, so where are black women if they are not affiliating in great numbers with these newborn suffrage associations? And it turns out that they are in their own institutions, in their churches, and making the case for their rights. This is the era in which, for example, in black Methodist churches, women will win the right to vote within the church. And they will struggle all the way to the end of the century around the question of whether or not they can be ordained fully as ministers. And this, as they would put it, was a woman's movement within the church that ran parallel to work of national suffrage associations.
Yeah, and going off of that, you know, it's been interesting to me to kind of see, you know, who gets honored today. You know, for instance, I saw you had written against the New York City Monument in Central Park to Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. It received tons of criticism for whitewashing the history of the movement. The people who created the monument kind of said it was marking the originators of this movement. I'm really struck by, you know, when we look back now, how much racism there really was within this. You know, Stanton in 1869 at the American Equal Rights Association, you know, she, quote, decried the possibility that white women would be made into the political subordinates of black men who were unwashed and fresh from the slave plantations of the South. That's something that you had written. I guess I would just be curious, you know, obviously we are not including these African-American women in these memorializations, but how should we be thinking about women like Stanton's legacy 100 years later?
We can remember the contributions they made in their institution building, in their long commitment to women's suffrage, but I don't think in 2019 we can remember that without also acknowledging that they did so at a price, and the price was a complicity with racism. Sometimes folks will say, you know, weren't these just women of their times? And the answer is, no, they were not. Women is a tricky term, isn't it? Once we appreciate that African American women are in these scenes, that African American women are as interested as any American women are in the question of their rights, in the question of suffrage, then it is hard to simply dismiss Stanton and Anthony as somehow typical because African-American women reveal to us the atypicality, if you will, of those kinds of ideas. So who should we remember? While we will want to remember Stanton and Anthony in all their complexity, we also would do well to search out quite deliberately those women who, I would say, embodied the kinds of values that were available to Americans.
Who comes to your mind as some?
Well, certainly we could talk about Ida B. Wells. We could talk about Hallie Quinn Brown. These are Black women suffragists who are deeply committed to their own political empowerment and the political empowerment of American women generally, and at the same time insist on doing that through a language and through an analysis that is about human rights, right? For African American women, the reason to win rights is not simply to satisfy the aspirations of women. It is to use political rights to extend human rights to all Americans, a particular political vision that is not the same oftentimes as that expressed by white women suffragists.
Yeah, and it strikes me too that, you know, the 19th Amendment in no way guaranteed the right of the vote for African American women. You know, that wasn't until the Voting Rights Act. Thinking about this 19th Amendment anniversary, is it something that should even be celebrated or marked by African American women at all? It didn't get them suffrage.
Black women work hard toward the 19th Amendment. These are women who have a long game in mind when it comes to Black women in political power, and they see the 19th Amendment as one step in a much longer struggle over voting rights. In cities like Chicago, for example, the work of historian Lisa Matterson has shown us the ways in which by the time we get to the 19th Amendment, African American women in Chicago are not only registered to vote, they are turning out at the polls, they are shaping the outcomes of elections. So the vote is not irrelevant to African American women in 1920. It is deeply relevant, and it is a victory, but it is a partial one. And so celebrate the 19th Amendment, take a deep breath, and continue the work, because until that long project of challenging Jim Crow is completed, a Civil Rights Act, a Voting Rights Act, a Fair Housing Right, you know, all of those victories of the modern civil rights era, until that work is done, the work of voting rights for African American women is far from done.
That's Martha Jones. She teaches history at Johns Hopkins and is also a Society of Black Alumni presidential professor. Her upcoming book, Vanguard, A History of African American Women's Politics, comes out in 2020. Stay with us. Coming up, the soundtrack to the modern women's rights movement. I'm Zoe Mitchell. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Zoe Mitchell. All this hour, we're hearing conversations to mark 100 years of women's suffrage in Massachusetts.
Strong, strong, stand we at last.
That's the Boston Children's Chorus singing March of the Women at Faneuil Hall last week. The song was written in 1910 by Ethel Smith and Cicely Hamilton and became the official anthem of the United Kingdom's Women's Social and Political Union. the union's newspaper described it as, quote, at once a hymn and a call to battle. March of the Women was also adopted by suffragettes in the U.S.
Open your eyes to the blaze of day.
Music has been a part of the women's movement, but not always in the way we expect. For instance, in 2017, at the Women's March in Washington, D.C., Alicia Keys led the audience in a chant of her song, Girl on Fire.
Feet on the ground!
Feet on the ground!
Not backing down!
Not backing.
This girl is on fire!
This rendition became something greater than a pop song. It was a piece of modern-day protest music. That's according to James Sullivan, who writes about the moment in his book, Which Side Are You On? 20th Century American History in 100 Protest Songs. He's also a longtime contributor to the Boston Globe and a former critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. WBUR's Anthony Brooks spoke with him in January, and he began by asking Sullivan to define what makes a protest song.
The fact is, at least in my mind, that protest songs can kind of come from anywhere, and they can be any style of music. There's protest music all over if you know where to look for it. And some of it's on the top 40 charts. Some of it's on the pop charts.
Well, since we're marking the 2-year anniversary of the Women's March, I want to focus specifically on what you've written about the history of women's protest songs. So I want to go back to 1964 with You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore and talk about this song for a bit. Let's listen to this first. I love that. Such a great sound. But I found your story about this song so interesting. So Leslie Gore performs it live at the Tammy Awards in 1964. So tell us what remind us what the Tammy Awards were and why this was such a significant and surprising song to hear at that event.
The Tammy Show was a filmed concert event, an all-star concert event in Southern California, that was intended to be filmed using some sort of cutting-edge technology at the time, and that was then going to be shown in movie theaters around the country. And the idea was that all the big stars of the day were going to come out and sing, and it was going to be sort of like a pre-Woodstock, except in the movie theaters. Hmm. So James Brown, the Rolling Stones were both famously there, and Leslie Gore, who was at that moment just about the biggest pop star in the country. And so her performance of You Don't Own Me on that show, it came out at the time that Bob Dylan was becoming, you know, tip of the tongue for music listeners around the country in 1964. I don't think anyone would have at the time looked at Leslie Gore and said she's a protest singer. However, over the next several years, as the women's movement became what it did in the 60s and early 70s, that song was adopted because it was specifically about the fact that women can make choices for themselves. They don't need to rely on their boyfriend or their man or their husband to make them for them.
Right. And it really represented a sort of departure in the pop song world, didn't it? Where they were usually women were sort of portrayed as being indulgent and sort of putting up with male antics, essentially.
Sure. And that was right at the height of what was called the girl group era, which was, you know, female voices, you know, sort of dominating the pop charts and pop radio. And most of those songs were about sort of being subservient to your boyfriend. And this song was absolutely a reaction to that or a response to that. Written by two men, exactly. They were from Philadelphia. They originally wrote it for an African American young woman, but when they heard Dionne Warwick's version of her song "Don't Make Me Over," that song came directly from Dionne Warwick saying to her songwriters, "Hey, you know, don't try to make me what I'm not. You know, let me be who I am. Don't make me over.
Don't make me over. Now that make me over. Now that you know how I adore you, don't pick on the things."
So the two guys from Philadelphia heard that song and they were inspired to write You Don't Own Me, which is sort of another message song, and that's where that came from.
Really interesting. I want to go back in time and talk about a genre that I love, and that's the blues. So this is Bessie Smith's version of Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do, a song that was first recorded by Alberta Hunter. But both women recorded the song in the same year, 1923. So let's listen a little bit. So I loved reading about this, and it was a bit of a revelation to me, and I'm sort of ashamed to admit this. I never associated this song with women's protests, because I've always associated with a lot of male singers over the years, including B.B. King, Willie Nelson,
sure,
among others. So tell me about this version by Bessie Smith and how it fits into the history of protests.
Well, like a lot of songs, it's sort of an all-purpose protest song. I mean, sure, if a guy sings it, he's saying, you know, I'll do things the way I want to do it. But it was originally performed, as you mentioned, by female singers, and the tradition of female blues singers, or shouters, or belters, as they were known, in the, you know, these strong voiced women in the 20s, was such that they, you know, they were singing songs like this one that were very much independent minded and saying, and that's what this song specifically represents. It's that, you know, hey, I'll live my life the way I want to, and you're not going to tell me otherwise.
Right. But fair to say that the blues of this period, not widely recognized as sort of feminist music or offering feminist music?
Sure. Although the activist Angela Davis wrote a whole book about some of these women, you know, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, Ida Cox, basically making this point that they were feminists way ahead of their time.
Speaking of Ida Cox, let's listen to another song from this time period, Wild Women Don't Have the Blues, by the uncrowned queen of the blues, Ida Cox.
I hear these women raving about their monkey men, about their trifling husbands and their no good friends. These poor women sit around all day and moan, wondering why their wondering paupers don't come home. But wild women don't worry, wild women don't have no blues.
Wild women don't have no blues. So tell me about this. Among other things, she's indicting women who sit at home and moan about their no-good husband. So,
right.
So this is a call for women to really get up and take control, right?
Right. And in fact, Ida Cox was one of the very first women in the entertainment world to sort of run her own business. She ran a touring company. She was the star, and she was also the owner and operator. You know, this is an example. I think that one of my thoughts in writing this book was that whole genres of music, from the blues to rock and roll to punk and hip-hop, have been established on a certain level as a form of protest, you know, as a reaction to something that the makers of that music felt was being disrespected on their part.
Interesting. So, James, you compiled a final list of songs emblematic of women's protest music, and I was struck that you didn't include Helen Reddy's I Am Woman, although you did write about it. This was released in 1971. It became hugely popular by the end of 1972. Let's listen to a bit of it.
I am strong,
strong.
I am invincible,
invincible.
I am woman.
So tell us about this song.
Helen Reddy actually spoke several times about sort of surprising herself that she, when she wrote this song, you know, she felt at the time that she did not feel like she would necessarily have called herself a feminist, but also looked around and felt like, you know, okay, the time has come for a song like this, and she was inspired to do it. And obviously she showed up at the Women's March in L.A. 2 years ago to sing that song and got a huge reception from the biggest crowd at any of the women's marches that happened around the country.
Hmm. Let's move on. I want to talk about another song. I had never heard this song, or if I did, I'd forgotten about it. It's called The Pill by Loretta Lynn, and it's a literal reference to the birth control pill. Let's hear a little bit.
This old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts,
I love this song. You say this is the song that when the debate over women's reproductive rights spilled uncomfortably over into the country music world.
Yeah, well,
what kind of reaction was there?
Country music was, you know, at the time in the 60s and early 70s, certainly sort of a reactionary world. And there were a number of songs, actually, by strong women like Tammy Wynette and Loretta Lynn that were intended to say, hey, you know, this isn't just a man's world. But the reaction was strong enough that Loretta Lynn cut the song, I think, in 1972, and her record company didn't actually release it until 75. They told her, you know, nobody's ready for this yet. Huh. And they finally released it in 75. And it's a great song. And she knew it at the time. And, she, you know, it was frustrating for her that the record company wasn't on board with releasing it.
And when it finally came out in 75, what kind of reaction did it get?
Pretty much what the record company thought it was going to get. You know, yeah. There were a lot of, you know, radio programmers and the like, you know, not wanting to play it or, you know, banning it from their stations or whatever because they felt like it was incendiary or it was, you know, sort of subverting the norms in the country. World, which is what it was doing.
Okay, one final song I want to talk about. It needs no introduction, so let's just dive right into it.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take F-T-C-T.
So, of course, the legendary Aretha Franklin and Respect. Why do you think this song took off at the time?
Well, first of all, because it's a killer song, but also it's a killer song. But if you're talking about interpretations of the songs, there were those who felt like it was a song about the civil rights movement, and there were those who thought it was a song about feminism and the women's movement. So, Aretha's sister Carolyn once said, you know, it's both of those things because there are all kinds of people who need more respect. And the great story about that song, I think, is that Otis Redding wrote it, but when he heard Aretha sing it, he said, play it again, play it again. I want to hear it again. And he kept saying, you know what? She stole my song and I can't be more proud of, you know, of that fact. Like she made it something completely different and he was thrilled.
It's so interesting that you remind us that Otis Redding wrote it. And of course, this is one of those facts that I heard a long time ago for the first time. And yet every time I hear it, I'm surprised about it anew because I think of it as Aretha Franklin's
just
song.
Just as Otis felt, you know, yeah. She made it her own. She took that song away from me and that's fine because she deserves it.
That's James Sullivan, a longtime contributor to the Boston Globe and former critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, speaking with WBUR's Anthony Brooks in January. Stay with us. Coming up, the parallels between the long struggle for votes and current-day struggles to break the glass ceiling. I'm Zoe Mitchell. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Zoe Mitchell. All this hour, we're hearing conversations to mark 100 years of women's suffrage in Massachusetts. Earlier in the hour, we heard from historian Barbara Berenson, who says that the movement for women's suffrage didn't begin in Seneca Falls, New York. It began earlier, right here in the state of Mass, when women argued for their right to have a voice on political issues. Today, women have the freedom to speak up in politics, but we are not always listened to as much as our male counterparts. Cheryl Clyburn Crawford, Executive Director of Mass Vote, spoke at a celebration of 100 years of suffrage in Mass.
Once again, we are fighting for the same right to determine our own destinies in 2019 as we did in 1920 and again in 1965. We are in an interesting place, and I am not sure we should be celebrating or we even have the time to celebrate because there's still so much more to do. Democracy should not be this hard.
High on that list of priorities for women to achieve real parity in politics, a woman as president of the United States. That's according to Ellen Fitzpatrick, a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. She is also the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. And I spoke with her about the parallels between the long struggle for votes and current day struggles to break the glass ceiling.
I think it's all part of the longer arc of American women's history. And you could really bring the story back to the colonial period, which historians do, in which women were very restricted by English common law. In time, as that evolved, of course, women's legal rights expanded, but in the 19th century, it was really the thrust of the women's rights movement. The first phase of this was to try to enable women, to free women, to have an independent role as citizens. And that's why the vote mattered so much to the women's rights activists. It was really, in some sense, the most radical thing in the Seneca Falls Declaration of 1848. From there, we have the modern women's movement, and it's all part of this longer story of establishing an independent identity for women as citizens that is, in some sense, equal, of course, to men and to all other people in the United States of America.
Yeah, interesting. So last week at Faneuil Hall, you know, there was a celebration marking 100 years since Massachusetts approved the 19th Amendment. You know, and at that event, speaking of women in government today, Mass Senate President Karen Spilka pointed out the disparities between women and men in the Massachusetts legislature right now.
We still have a long way to go to reach full equality when it comes to women's representation on Beacon Hill and other areas of power. Only 210 women have served in the Massachusetts legislature. 210 women compared to over 20,000 men.
And, you know, of course, she's referring there to decades of leadership. And we have seen women in the past couple years, you know, really achieve remarkable gains as far as holding office. Right now, there are a record number of women serving in Congress, as you know. But, you know, there's still only 23%. And in state legislatures, only 28% are made up of women. You know, I'm just curious, are these gains and are these records something to celebrate? Or where do you feel we are now as far as women in these spaces?
Well, I think they're definitely things to celebrate, but they're also quite sobering. I remember reading an article many years ago, a feminist sort of talking about learning about these heroic figures in American women's history, dating back to the 19th century and women activists then, and being very, very inspired by them, and concluding the article by saying, she was inspired, not sobered. That would come later. In other words, when she realized that so many of these issues that had animated the early women's rights activists over 150 years ago were still relevant today. So, yes, women's voting rights were absolutely central, but it didn't necessarily open the political process to women gaining political office as rapidly as some feminists had hoped and others had feared.
You know, on that point, I just thought it was interesting to read about what some of those barriers were to suffrage back then. You know, men and even women were against this cause, and Massachusetts was the first state with an organized anti-suffrage group. This opposition has always been there. You know, arguments include that women didn't want the right to vote. They didn't have the time to vote. They lacked, you know, the mental capability or expertise to vote. I guess thinking of those issues 100 years later, what do you view as kind of the biggest issues today still keeping women from political parity?
I think that there remains obstacles within the political parties that have been a very significant obstacle for women all along the way. That is, gaining power within the political party and being taken seriously. Now, that dovetails, however, with the realities of ongoing social, cultural resistance to the notion of women as leaders, that we tend to think those ideas are antediluvian. Most Americans today would say, that are polled, do say they'd be happy to have a woman president as long as it's the right woman. Well, there hasn't been the right woman in a century that has emerged. So the political parties want to win elections. And as long as there's a sense in the larger body politic that voters may be resistant to voting for women into whatever office, they're not going to want to advance women candidates. Historically, that was true. Another huge variable is raising money. Hillary Clinton overcame a lot of these obstacles. Of course, her success in overcoming all of these obstacles, she became a party insider. She raised a tremendous amount of money. Mm-hmm. She had a high national profile. She had the experience. We're also the source of tremendous criticism of her in each of those areas. So talk about you can't win.
Yeah.
You know, it's very complicated.
Yeah, and speaking of 2016, I'd love to play a moment of Hillary Clinton's concession speech.
I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now.
Ellen, do you think we should view a woman president as kind of the final frontier of parity in, of women and men in politics, or is there something else? How do you view that?
I don't think it's the final frontier, but I think it's an important symbolic breakthrough. And I have no doubt that it will happen. And I think that, in fact, Hillary Clinton's run in 2016 will be seen, once it does happen, as absolutely central to that outcome. Does it matter? Yes. Is it going to solve all the problems? Is it going to erase women's inequality in the political realm? Very doubtful.
Yeah. I'm curious about what you make of what's happening right now. I mean, we have six women who are on the debate stage this year. When Clinton ran, she was alone on stage. You know, what kind of difference does that make? And, you know, you say you expect it to happen. How soon do you see that
coming? I don't know how soon, but I do think that what Hillary Clinton achieved, she demonstrated that a woman can be a credible candidate. She won the popular vote, and she was able to tick off all of those boxes, and she got pretty darn close. And that, I think, really has emboldened women. And the fact that she was able to secure the nomination, there are those who wish she hadn't, of course, but the fact that she did, I think, has really opened these floodgates.
What do you think we can learn or take away from the suffragists and the suffrage movement going forward?
I think the key thing to realize is that they remain true to their cause over hundreds of years. The suffrage story, we think about the effort to get votes for women, is a very long one, from the early 19th century, and one could argue even earlier than that, right into our current day of expanding access to the franchise for various members of our society. And so I think the story is that these struggles are long, that they do not yield quick results, that they require a broad grassroots movement who are organizing at the grassroots locally, the state level, and really creating networks that are going to make a difference. That's where the struggle lies. And can't give up. You just got to keep going.
That's Ellen Fitzpatrick, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. She is also the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Before we end this hour, I want to play one final rumination on this 100-year anniversary of women's suffrage. So the last word this Independence Day goes to Attorney General Maura Healey, speaking at Faneuil Hall last week.
I also want this year to be a time when we double down and commit and recommit and re-energize ourselves and reaffirm the importance of the fight, the worth of the fight, the pain and the patience needed for the fight, but to commit ourselves to the fight, because so much needs to happen right now. And I think the best way we can honor the suffragists is by setting forth an example by way of action starting now.
That wraps up our special hour marking 100 years of women's suffrage in Massachusetts.
This girl is on fire!
Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Tiziana Deering is our host. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston, and have a happy Independence Day.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.